my great privilege to welcome the Australian organist Marco Sever as my guest on this podcast. Welcome, Marco.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Thank you so much for making the time to talk to us today about this extraordinary subject. So, what do you make of this amazing journey that Bach took on foot when he was 20?
I mean, it's an extraordinary undertaking. It's a long way to travel, and not least because he almost lost his job over this. This is his first post in Arnstadt, I think. And his employer kept writing to him saying, if you don't come back soon, we're going to have to find another organist. But he stayed for a further 3 months. And I think, you know, this is a young man who's very passionate about what he wants to do. And he was so hell-bent on learning with Buxtehude that no one was going to get in his way. And I just think, you know, what an awesome thing to do.
Yes, absolutely. He was so young, wasn't he, to undertake that journey alone?
Yeah, I'm not sure what travelling around Germany was like in those days, but I'm sure there were probably highwaymen or things like that. So it would have been quite a dangerous journey, I can imagine. I mean, it's not dissimilar to so many other young people's journeys now. I mean, you and I both went to the UK, for example, much less treacherous a journey, of course, nowadays. But so many people who go to the Con or the Melbourne Con or whatever want to go overseas now to further their careers. And in some ways, this is parallel to what he did. So I think it gets to a point in a young person's life where they feel like they ought to leave the nest. And this was Bach's version of doing just that, although at a much younger age.
I know, you're right. We are sort of, you and I, are our continuations of that very tradition, aren't we? But it does take a certain type of person to just set off alone on foot. What kind of person do you think you'd have to be to attempt such a physically demanding journey as well?
I mean, you've just got to be passionate about it. There's no two ways about it. I mean, you've got to be thirsty for knowledge, and you're pretty certain that this is what you want to do in life. And particularly if you've heard someone or you know about a particular group or a particular place where there's a wonderful organ or something, or perhaps a combination of all of those three, in my case. I mean, once you set your eyes on something like that, for me that was just Westminster Cathedral. I mean, once I'd heard that choir and heard that organ, I just didn't know that that kind of music was possible. So I thought, I've got to go and hear this. And then the first time I went there, first of all, my jaw just dropped because what an incredible building. But also, when the organ started playing, it sort of envelops you in this sort of like this sound world, and it sort of goes through you. And then the choir starts singing, and you've just never heard anything like it before. And ever since then, I was smitten. I'd got the bug, and so I was a young man at this point. I thought, I've got to come back here, and I did. And, you know, the rest is history. So, well, yeah.
Those of us out there might not know your history. Tell me a little bit about your journey to being an organist.
Well, it's a bit of a rocky one. I mean, I left school and I decided I wanted to do music at university, but I wasn't quite sure about it at the time. But it wasn't until about my third or fourth year when I realised I really want to do this. And in doing so, in travelling to and from, you know, Europe, I thought this is exactly what I want to do. And also being surrounded by people, I find, certain people who are often better than you, slightly older than you, understandably, and being surrounded by these people, I find it totally inspiring. I don't know, you've probably heard, I don't want to sound too derogatory here, but it's sort of big fish in a small pond syndrome. And then you leave, you know, your pond, as it were, and then all of a sudden you're surrounded by lots of other big fish. You think, well, this is great, isn't it? I've got to do some work now, though. So, yeah. Is that quite similar to what your journey entails?
My journey, well, I did feel very similar to you, actually. I did feel I wanted to be part of a wider world, and I knew there was this big world out there, and I'd been fortunate to go on an Australian youth orchestra tour to Europe when I was 16 and learning in Europe. It was funny. I just felt like I was home the second I got off the plane. It was very odd, in Amsterdam of all places. But there started my journey and my desire a wider world and wider music making. And then I went to study in London. Like you, the rest is history. But I can't can very much understand this desire of Bach's to widen his world. And it, you know, we've talked a lot about how he never left Germany, but he did his best, didn't he, to get out there and to travel and to learn.
He got close to leaving Germany. I suppose North Germany is sort of bordering on, what is it, Denmark at the moment? Or in those days it would have been. But yeah, he was definitely hell-bent on what he wanted to do. And I find that totally extraordinary. And have you ever been in a building and just sort of looked around and thought, oh my gosh, this is where he worked. You know, this is where it all happened. And here I am 300 years later or something. Just totally inspired by that thought.
I am. It's sort of one of the wonderful things about being a musician, isn't it? Knowing that you're part of a rich, long line of continuation of learning and studying and performing, and it's incredible to be also to be in the sort of ghostly presence of the master.
Yeah, I know. It's like how many world premieres of this piece happened here?
I know. Yeah. Absolutely. So why do you think it was so important for him to make this huge journey to hear Buxtehude specifically?
I mean, Buxtehude was highly regarded in Germany as a pioneer of organ composition, not just composition, but improvisation, which is an art form that a lot of other musicians that might be aware of, but certainly don't have to do in practice. You didn't always have time to write a new piece for Sunday. So what you might often have to do is improvise a voluntary at the end of a service. And Buxtehude's improvisations were certainly a thing to behold, if legend is to be trusted. And Bach, I think, wanted to go and hear this, and he wanted to go and learn from the master. And also Buxtehude was one of the first composers writing for a particular kind of organ, which his predecessors, you know, like Böhm, like Bruns, and like Pachelbel, weren't really shackled by the organ in the sort of way that Bach was, or Buxtehude in that case, because the organ didn't really have pedal towers, it didn't have huge pedal divisions, which were able to create these great big ground swells of bass. And they certainly weren't capable of the kind of virtuosic music that Buxtehude and Bach were writing. So all of a sudden, we've got this new style of music emerging, and somebody who's actually not just you know, keeping up with it, but pioneering in this particular field. And you know, I think of Buxtehude's Prelude in C Major, the 137. It starts with the great big pedal solo, and I mean, that's something that Pachelbel would never have been able to write. Well, he might have done, but it wouldn't have been possible on the organs that were available to them. Certainly. So he's just taken it to the nth degree.
Interesting. Yeah. That's so interesting. So you're saying that Bach didn't have, not Bach, but J.C. Bach and Pachelbel and Bruns wouldn't have actually had the instruments to experiment on like Buxtehude would have.
I just don't think the organs had that particular facility to be able to play great big pedal solos and things like that. I mean, single pedal notes might have been possible, but a bit like in the French classical style, you could kind of only play like one pedal note at a time, but to actually do great sort of passage work on the pedals, that was not going to happen. And if it was possible, they didn't have these great big pedal towers, which, you know, these North German organs are characterized by. When you play a pedal note, there's lots there, rather than, you know, it just being sort of a trumpet or something like that.
Interesting. That's so interesting. Wow. And on this journey he took with him, you've mentioned Georg Böhm and Nicolas Bruns. We know what music he did take with him. And why did he choose to take this music with him? Did he play it to Buxtehude? Did he want to show Buxtehude this music? Do you think Buxtehude would have known it?
I'm not sure that there's much that Bach could have shown Buxtehude at the age of 15. Although, who knows what? I mean, he must have been writing some extraordinary stuff at the age of 15. But I would have thought he'd gone over there to just, you know, osmose, just be part of Buxtehude's world and just watching what he does, and through osmosis trying to take it all in. And, you know, as a young musician, you want to be surrounded by people who are better than you, as we were talking about before. And one of those things is just osmosis, watching people do certain things, absorbing that, making it your own. And I think that's part of why he went over there, and part of why he wanted to be around this person. I mean, sometimes it feels totally inspiring to be around somebody who you've held in such high regard. And just that on its own will propel you to even further heights and it will encourage you to work harder.
Well, I could certainly say that's been my experience.
Yes.
But it is beautiful music. And those composers like Pachelbel, they really did influence Bach. I know that, you know, even before he began this epic journey, his first cousin once removed, Johann Christoph Bach, and Pachelbel, they really did look after him as a child, didn't they, when he was orphaned. So that beautiful piece was a little bit of the Pachelbel Chaconne in F minor for organ, P43. Well, we know that Johann Christoph Bach was there in Ortruf when Bach was orphaned and he had to go live with his older brother, another Johann Christoph Bach, who was 13 years older than him. And his first cousin, once removed, was a little bit older than him. And we know that it was this Johann Christoph Bach who encouraged the young Johann Sebastian to come and observe him build an organ in the local church. And he got to build this organ pipe by pipe with his first cousin. And then he learnt about the inner workings of that organ. And so he knew the organ from the inside out. Yeah, and we also know that Johann Christoph Bach was the first of what they sort of just talk about as being the profound Bach composers. I mean, we know there were all those generations of Bachs before Johann Sebastian came along, but they weren't all great composers. Johann Christoph Bach was the first one who stood out amongst the Bach family as being truly exceptional. And that's actually why I've chosen to include a piece of his in this program. Number one, because of the connection to this journey he made, his organ journey, if you like, Bach's, Johann Sebastian's journey with the instrument of the organ. But it really, really does connect to his first cousin because he helped him learn how to build them, as well as being, you know, what we consider the first profound Bach composer. And that was the complete Bach Chorale zum Präludium, Ein feste Burg ist unser Gott, not by Johann Sebastian, but by his first cousin, Johann Christoph Bach, that will be opening our concert.
It's interesting because a lot of organists they know how to play the organ, but they don't actually know how an organ is built or what goes on behind the scenes. And until recently, I must say, I was quite guilty of this, because how often do you see an organ being built? I mean, it must happen, you know, in a town every, you know, several decades or something like that, if that. I mean, we just had an organ built at St. James, and that's, you know, one of the first organs to be built in, you know, 20 years in Sydney. And unless you're there, you know, in the front seat, passenger seat, you're not going to witness what goes on, unless, of course, you actively go to a factory and, you know, observe what the workers there do and ask lots of questions, or in fact, become an organ builder. But, you know, beyond that, you know, not many people really know how it kind of works. And it seems to be this sort of like anathema, this thing off in the distance that we just assume it works. We're not quite sure how, but we're just here to play it. But it's really good that he did get to know how these organs work, because all of them would have been mechanical action, a tracker action organ, where you've got complete control of the key from the moment you play it down to the moment you release it. And when an organist is learning to play the organ for the first time, and they encounter one of these organs, which are tracker mechanical organs, they often they feel a little bit discouraged by it, because they don't sound as good as they might on an electric action organ, which does all the work for you. So all these chorale preludes, and this is one of the things, I'm just going to draw a parallel between J.C. Bach and J.S. Bach, because in J.C. Bach, Christoph wrote a lot of them. Preludes based on German chorales, and they were a little bit more on the simplistic side compared to what, you know, J.S. Had done, in the sense that, you know, fewer voices, less ornate, not as harmonically complex. Bach took this style and he created this chorale ornée. I mean, pieces like, we'll just, for example, say the Anwasserfluss in Babylon by J.C. Bach. There's not many voices to it, and there's not a lot of moving parts. It's beautiful in its simplicity, but then Bach was able to take that, and he wrote one of the most extraordinary chorale preludes, Anwasserfluss in Babylon, with embellishments and things like that. And he just drew it out. And one of the things that becomes very apparent with these sorts of pieces is, if you're not careful about your touch and release, the organ will punish you. It will bark, right. It will sort of spit at you. And if you get to the end of a lovely long passage and then you suddenly let go of the right hand, you know, solo, it will just snap shut. And it's almost as if you're playing the violin and then suddenly, instead of like gently releasing from the string, you just suddenly stop mid-flow. That's kind of what it sounds like, if I could kind of draw a parallel there. And that's where I think it's interesting that he learned how to build an organ, because he knows what's going on behind there and why it's important to play in this delicate way. So I think it will have influenced not only his composition, but certainly his musicality.
So what you just heard was a little bit of that amazing piece Marco was just talking about by Johann Sebastian Bach, An Wasserfluss in Babylon, BWV 653. Well, perhaps that was one silver lining to the devastating fact that he was orphaned at the age of 9, and he did have to go up to Ordruff and live with his older brother. Maybe if that hadn't happened, he would never have had that experience learning how to build organs. It's funny how these little sliding door moments happen and help legacy.
And I wonder how much it actually gave him comfort to compose and also to practice. I mean, certainly as an organist, it's a very solitary activity. You're up in the organ loft all alone. You're not competing for practice rooms in the back of concert halls and whatever, or conservatoires. You're there all alone, and actually there can be something quite nice about that. So perhaps throughout all his pain and discomfort and, you know, misery of being orphaned, assuming he was miserable, there will have been, you know, a great sense of relief when he finally came to the organ loft and he was just able to practice.
Yeah, well, that's one way of dealing with grief, isn't it? Yes, and I was often told
Absolutely.
by friends and colleagues, practice your worries away. And that's always stayed with me, actually.
Yeah, I think it only works for people who are really, really passionate about it. But if you're sort of like, oh, well, I don't really want to practice it. But I certainly love practicing. And it means I could switch my phone off and I could just be totally absorbed by the music. It's great.
It's a pretty unique feeling, isn't it?
Certainly is.
Now, I'm extremely excited about this new organ at St. James. Tell me a little bit about it and what we can expect to hear from this incredible new instrument.
Well, it's the newest organ in Sydney. It's the largest church organ in Sydney. It is characterized, I would say, by being a symphonic instrument with a slightly English accent. And the reason for that is when we had commissioned Dobson to build us an organ, we said we want this to be able to accompany the choir in the English cathedral tradition. And so it had to have as much expression as possible. It couldn't just be simply loud. It had to have lots of color, lots of different timbres. So it's all the way from the reeds down to the diapasons and the flutes. They all had to sort of meld and mesh with one another without being overpowering. And that, I think, was the thing which had to be observed in this building, because it's not an overly large building, St. James. It's not tiny, but it's also you can't, just play hell for leather all the time. So I think this organ, I'm getting to know it more and more every day. I've only had it for a few months to myself, but I think its great strength lies in the colours, and they're the sorts of colours which you might employ when playing something by Bach or Buxtehude or Brahms even, because there's more subtlety there than you might imagine from a new organ.
That's fantastic to hear. I just can't tell you how excited I am to hear you perform all these different pieces in our upcoming program. And for those of you who are listening, if you are into all of the colors that this organ can produce, and also this music, this is a golden opportunity to hear one of Australia's masters perform Bruns and Buxtehude and Georg Böhm and J.C. Bach and J.S. Bach all on the same night in the same place on this fabulous instrument. It's going to be really special.
Certainly is. I'm very excited. I always look forward to doing things with the Bach Academy, Madeline. You know that.
Well, ditto.
Yeah.
And one of the things which I'm really, really excited about is the chance to do a cantata in the context of how it would have been performed. So not with the little portable chamber organs which are so often carted around from venue to venue purely out of necessity, but to work with a great organ in a church in that role as both an obbligato and as a continuo organ.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly historical precedents for this. A lot of these North German organs will have a Ruck positive, or positive division, as it's called, but it's Ruck, so it's behind you, and that's hanging over the balcony. So you're essentially sandwiched as an organist between the Hauptwerk, the main part of the organ, and the Ruck positive. And the Ruck positive sits a little bit lower in the church. And when you put musicians under there, the actual organ that you're playing as a continuo instrument is not all that far away all of a sudden. But I find, I mean, I might be a bit biased in saying this, but you're able to, there are so many more colors you can choose from on a full-size organ than you could with, say, for example, a small chamber organ, where you've only got one 8 foot. You can't vary them out. You've just got to use that one sound all the time. Whereas with a much bigger organ, you can swap them, change them, and you can, depending on where you're up to in the piece. And there's a little bit more variety. So I would say it's probably even better.
I agree. I kind of agree, and I feel like I'm going to come to that conclusion, even though I'm not even in the room yet to hear it. But also, we're going to have so much more fun with dynamics, just for a start, you know. The chamber organ can only really give us a certain range of dynamics and registers and colours, but I feel like having all of these options, we can really go to town on,
We can, and we can do something. We can do something even more than what would have been possible even back then. Is we can use swell boxes, which didn't really come around until the 19th century. or certainly the end of the 18th century. And so we can actually fade to nothing if we want to. It wouldn't have been possible back in those days. But if we really want to, we can do that. And I think, why should we be limited by, you know, being historically accurate? Of course, it's important to know that you're breaking the rules, but you need to know the rules first. And I think if we're going to do something like that, we may as well take full advantage of what's on offer.
Yeah, and I think thereby we evolve, don't we? And we grow as musicians and performers, and, you know, music evolves.
Absolutely.
We're part of it, you know. We can't stand still and just do things the same way over and over and over and over again, can we?
No, that's right. We've all got iPads now, and we're all using those. So we don't need page turners anymore. You've got yours.
Yes,
I'm actually talking to you on mine as we speak.
My gosh. So the other place we're going to perform this wonderful program is up in Newcastle at Christ Church Cathedral. Now that, they tell me, has a very different kind of organ. What do you know about this organ?
Well, it's a large three-manual Hill, Norman and Beard organ. It's English in its style. It is meant to accompany the choir on a daily basis, or several times a week, certainly. So again, it's this kind of English romantic sound with loads of expression and quite a rich leathery diapasons. So there's quite a lot of foundational sounds there. We've got a vast pedal division as well. And so we've got an organ that's meant to accompany a congregation in hymn singing as well as accompanying a choir. So it's quite versatile in that sense, because unlike the organs of, for example, in North Germany, they might not have to accompany a choir. They might just have to lead a congregation and also play solo music. So we've got, you know, horses for courses, as it were. But the Christ Church Cathedral organ is certainly very beautiful in its tone, from what I hear. I've never actually played it before, but I'm very much looking forward to playing it because I've heard such wonderful things about it.
Are you looking forward to the experience of performing the same program on two very different instruments?
Yeah, I mean, variety is the spice of life, isn't it? I'll probably have some views afterwards. But yeah, I mean, it might shed new light on the piece, which you thought, oh, I never noticed that particular bit. And you wouldn't have noticed it there, but you noticed it somewhere else. Who knows? I mean, it would be certainly a different experience for the musicians, because we're dealing with two different acoustics. One is a little bit wetter and one's perhaps a bit drier, but more spacious. So the moment that, you know, you have downbow, you might notice straight away, this is a different space. This feels different. Not bad or worse, it's just different.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going to getting up to Newcastle as well, because again, it sort of connects me to the experience of traveling around and going into different churches and, you know, getting used to the space. And we're going to have to do a lot of argy-bargy, aren't we, sort of figuring out where we're going to sit in terms of sight lines and hearing lines and all of that. But that's part of the fun for me, you know.
It is. Well, there are challenges, and there will have to be some logistical things to sort out. I think certainly from my point of view, you can never go wrong with a mirror. I've certainly had lots of cameras in my time, and cameras can go wrong, and we can have power outages, and certainly with mirrors that's not affected. So I tend to go for the old-fashioned method.
I believe that's fail-safe. I mean, just last year I had an horrendous experience with a time delay coming from an organ to the stage, and I was conducting and it was always behind, and nightmare.
Yeah, we certainly found these old sort of black and white cameras with their little monitors. They had the lowest latency of any cameras out there. And so even in so many organ lofts today, you will find these old-fashioned cameras and monitors, because they connect you to the conductor more closely than a digital.
I love that. Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, maybe, you know, old school is best school sometimes.
Sometimes that's certainly true. Yeah.
But anyway, Marco, thank you so much for being my guest on this. It's been wonderful to hear your insights on the organ and all of the wonderful ways you've been talking about what it is to play it and the significance of these pieces. Just to finish with, I just want you to tell me, in your opinion, how you think Bach's music changed after he did go up and hear Buxtehude, and what was the legacy of that trip for all of us,
I think it certainly challenged Bach. And it opened up to him a world of possibility, which he probably thought wasn't even possible. I imagine the first time he ever heard Books to Huda, he would have, you know, just thought, "What? How is he doing this? Why does that work? I've never heard anything like that before." And then from that will have grown a deep desire to want to figure out how it worked. And Books to Huda would have had to show him how it worked. He'd have to study his scores. And I think, you know, this thirst for knowledge has had a profound impact on him and the rest of us as a result, because it just goes to show that this art form is never finished. It's always emerging. It's always evolving, and it's never quite finished. But it's just amazing how we got here, having gone through all that. And then, you know, all of a sudden we've got postmodern music, which evolved from something, you know, much older. I think that's just totally fascinating.
And that was a little bit of the Dietrich Buxtehude Toccata in F major, BUX WV156. I agree. I absolutely agree. And this piece we're playing, BWV170, that we're finishing the program with, is obviously one of the most loved Bach cantatas out there for countertenor and organ obbligato. And this piece is, I think, a direct result of that amazing journey that JS took on foot. And we have this legacy, and then others would have heard those cantatas and then been inspired by them. Mozart, Beethoven, all the great masters ever since. So you never know. If Bach had never made that journey, what would music be like? Who knows? But we're very glad
he did. We're very glad he did indeed.
Yes. Brave new world he entered into.
Yeah, that's right.
So thank you so much, Marco. And please come and hear this fantastic man, Marco Seva, perform all these works with Bach Academy Australia at St. James Church on Friday, the 20th of September at 7:30 p.m. in Sydney, and on Sunday, the 22nd of September at Christ Church Cathedral in Newcastle. It will be wonderful. Thank you so much, Marco.
Thank you, Madeline. I look forward to it.